Neil deGrasse Tyson is a world-famous astrophysicist and the director of the American Museum of Natural History's Hayden Planetarium. This Monday, April 20th, he'll add late-night talk show host to his resume when he turns his popular podcast, Star Talk, into National Geographic Channel's first-ever late-night series. Today, Mr. Tyson joins us for Please Explain, and I know it's asking a lot, but we're expecting him to clear up all of the secrets of the cosmos for us. I'm very pleased to welcome Neil deGrasse Tyson back to our show. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
And if you are listening, if you have a question about the cosmos, we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. And congratulations on your debut as a late night talk show host. Have you asked David Letterman or Stephen Colbert or Jon Stewart for any tips?
I think the media overplayed the announcement. They heard that there'd be this
You were replacing Colbert,
that's not true. It was like Tyson takes on late night, and there he is. And no, it's going to air one night a week. And there is no band. There's no monologue.
But there are comedians.
Yeah, definitely. But the structure is just what the radio show was and podcast, where we blend comedy, science, and pop culture. My co-host is always a professional comedian, and my guests are hardly ever scientists, people hewn from pop culture, and this is what we're presenting on Late Night.
And I'm assuming it's addressed to adults. Kids are really fascinated by by astrophysics. But if it's on a late night time, you're going to have to deal with adult approaches to this story.
Everything I've ever done professionally has always targeted adults. It's when, but much of that kids could also consume. So I've never targeted children in anything I've ever done. And the conversation deals with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. If that's the topic, we don't withhold that. Especially since those topics tend to be very central in pop culture evaluations.
Is this a way of actually explaining complex scientific concepts?
No, that's not the goal. That's the stereotype of what a science program would be. Sit down and learn science. That's not what's going on Star Talk. In fact, that could be why it jumped species to late night television, because it is a different product. Because I'm interviewing pop culture people, it is not about learning lesson plans that you might catch in a textbook. The goal, our objective initially, and remains, to bring science to people who don't know that they like science, or people who know that they don't like science. How do you reach them? And our expectation, which has borne out in the numbers for the radio show and the podcast, is we bring in a pop culture figure, and my conversation with that person orbits their profession but plugs science into what it is they do. So one of our guests, we pre-taped these, one of our guests is President Jimmy Carter. Now, I didn't ask him about the Middle East. Most people would, because obviously he has history there. I asked him about his engineering background. We had a whole conversation about when he taught celestial navigation to fellow midshipmen Navy people.
Didn't he study nuclear physics?
Yeah. So he has some background in that. And so we had a whole conversation about the ways that informed his diplomacy, his negotiations. And so the goal of Star Talk is really to display for the viewer and the listener previously, and now also the viewer, all the ways that science threads through life. And in that way, you can't tell yourself that you're going to step around it or over it or neglect it. You say, well, that's science, but I'm into something else. No, science is into you.
If I remember correctly, the first time you were on the show was when you became director of the American Museum of Natural History.
Yeah, we go way back.
Planetarium.
You and I
How long ago
back.
Was that?
In fact, we're probably in the 20th anniversary of that coming up this year.
And astrophysics has gotten a lot more complicated over those decades. Things like dark matter, we understand a bit more about. The Higgs boson string theory has continued to be... confusing.
Yeah, bring it on. Yeah, it's people think that scientists sit in their offices, legs up on the table, basking in their mastery of the universe. No, we are always at the drawing board. You know, if I had a nickel for every time a journalist started a science article saying, this new discovery will send scientists back to the drawing board. If you are not at the drawing board to begin with, you are not on the frontier. We're always befuddled staring at unsolved equations on the drawing board. And now with dark matter, dark energy, Higgs boson, how do you solve that? Parallel universes, string theory. It's more occasions for us to be humbled in the presence of the universe.
And this week, scientists, not going back to the drawing boards, but already being there, released the first of several dark matter maps of the cosmos. How do you map dark matter?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Dark matter is cool to map because...
You can't see it.
No, we can't see it. No, we don't. It's not detectable in any traditional sense, but it has gravity. And you can see its effect on other things. So you can make a map of where the dark matter would be to have its gravitational consequence on the things you do see. And so then you can make a map of it. Now, by the way, we call
it... And then what will that help us understand?
Well, any possible thing we can measure about it is a start. It's like coming up to the elephant. We don't know it's an elephant yet, but get all the data you can. Maybe one day we'll step back and say, hey, that's an elephant. Mm-hmm. But right now, we're the blind men touching different aspects of the universe, trying to make sense of it all.
Even the whole idea of dark matter, it was invented or conceived of partly because you had to explain certain things,
yeah,
and there was no way to explain
it. I would go further and say that it shouldn't have ever been called dark matter at all, because that implies we know something enough about it to think of it as matter. It should be called,
or that it's dark.
It should be called. Well, it is definitely dark. It doesn't. There's no light emitted, and it doesn't interact with our light. More accurately, we should call it dark gravity, which to me is a little more mysterious and romantic. But it is gravity that has no known origin. Dark gravity. That is a fact. That there's no better factual description of what we're seeing than calling it dark gravity. At which point, you can't say, "Oh, we're inventing something to explain it." Yeah, there's gravity and we don't know what it is, and it's dark. It's the matter word in the term that's really shouldn't have ever been there from the beginning.
So it wouldn't be matter even though it...
We don't know what it is. I don't know. I call it Fred. That's the name of it. A new word for it. Fred. That's the name of new name for dark matter. And now you can't ask me any follow-up questions about the word.
I'm calling it Alvin Dark.
Okay, fine.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is our guest on today's Please Explain. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. This week it was also announced that there's evidence that's been found that there has been – that there's water or has been water on Mars. How important is that discovery?
Yeah, well, we've always had sort of the surface evidence that water had run rampant on the Martian surface. Not only catastrophically, there are examples of floodplains and things, but there are also lake beds that have dried and left sort of mineral deposits at the bottom.
Well, it also has less gravity than Earth. So would that mean that water wouldn't... I'm imagining it floating off.
Yeah. Just because it has less gravity doesn't mean it has no gravity. Uh-huh. Yeah, if it has any gravity at all, it's going to be pulled down. The Mars has about... You weigh about 40% of your current weight on Mars. So if you're, if you're 100 pounds on Earth, you weigh 40 pounds on Mars, if I remember. A little less than 40 pounds.
God,
so
that's a reason to go there, I think.
No. So, yeah, the problem is weight loss programs are really mass loss programs because you want to actually lose mass in your body. I can easily make you lose weight. Just go to a different part of the Earth where the gravitational force is lower, or put you in orbit and you weigh nothing. But that doesn't get your fat off of your body if that's what you're targeting.
There are places on Earth where I would weigh less?
Yeah. On tops of mountains, you weigh less.
Oh.
And on the equator, you weigh a little less because the Earth is spinning, mm-hmm. trying to fling you off. And so you weigh a few ounces less on the equator, a couple ounces less on the tops of mountains. You're farther away from Earth's center. And the farther away you are from Earth's center, the less you will weigh.
Sometimes science...
So you didn't know that, yeah. Let people
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah. So the thing is, if you ascend...
I'm not sure I want to climb a mountain to lose
weight. Yeah, you would lose more weight climbing the mountain than what you would have... than the claim you would then make of yourself for being farther away from the center of the Earth.
Yeah, well, you have to schlep the scale all the way up there.
Yeah.
One of the big surprises science sometimes has surprises is that the Curiosity rover is still going strong many years after it was supposed to stop.
Well, just to clarify that, it's not the life expectancy of space hardware is the reported life expectancy is, okay, I have this experiment I want to conduct. I want the instrument to work to this precision and this accuracy, and you define those parameters, and the engineers build it for you, and then you send it up. And then 2 years later, when that period is over, The machine still works? Well, of course it still works. But it's not getting data with the precision and accuracy that you had specified. Now you get 10% accuracy instead of, you know, the specs start decaying. And so, but rather than give up, you'd rather get some data rather than no data, even if the data are of lesser quality. So we shouldn't be surprised ever when a piece of space hardware goes beyond its
like Voyager,
its life expectancy, like Voyager.
On the other hand, Hubble, which started off as a troubled experiment,
coming up on the 25th anniversary of its
launch.
But
now it's finally going to be retired.
Couldn't they
just send somebody up there and fix it the way they did last time?
No, because you need the space shuttle to do it, and we don't have a space shuttle, so it's done.
Send the Russians up there?
No, they don't have it. You have to, like, grab the thing, put it in, you know, and fix it, and no, it's the shuttle that did this. And the space station has a completely different orbit, so you can't say, I'll be right back, honey. I'm going to, I'll be home for dinner after I leave the space station and go to the Hubble. They're completely different orbits at different elevations and everything.
Are we planning to send up a new, better version of the Hubble?
Yeah, the James Webb Space Telescope, previously known as the Next Generation Space Telescope. That will not be serviceable, so it will not have the lifetime, the renewed lease on life that Hubble had enjoyed four consecutive times.
Well, Hubble's been extraordinary once it was fixed anyway. What would the James Webb do that Hubble couldn't do?
Yeah, James Webb is a bigger telescope, so it'll see dimmer things no matter what.
It's further into time.
Yeah, if you see something dim, you'll see something that doesn't emit much light that's nearby that you might have previously missed, or something that emits a lot of light but it's so far away that it's really dim, previously falling below your thresholds. So with the James Webb Space Telescope, it's tuned to see deep into the infrared part of the spectrum. Now, here's what's interesting. That'll get you deep into gas clouds, and you'll see stars being born, because infrared can escape gas clouds in a way that visible light can't. But more importantly, you'll see galaxies being born in the early universe that, at the time, were emitting ultraviolet light from the birth of stars, and that light has been redshifted all the way down to the infrared. So this telescope is tuned specifically to see the redshifted light of the birthing galaxies. And so it'll move a frontier, the next generation, as we wanted and as we expect.
But the Hubble wasn't able to do that despite
The Hubble also went into the gas clouds, and it also saw really dim things, and it also had great resolution for detail on things in the universe. But James Webb is bigger in astrophysics and in telescopes, bigger is better. Hmm. As much as people like to debate that in other areas of life, bigger telescopes, you can see dimmer and farther at all times.
How much did the Hubble actually reveal to us about things that had been mysteries until then? I mean, the images turn out to be gorgeous, and that some of them seem inexplicable to me. They look more like some of the best abstract paintings I've ever seen. But
They can be Rorschach tests for people. Yeah, what do you see? Right.
But do we know things that we didn't know before as a result?
Well, the Hubble telescope, it being an optical telescope, it did better at looking at various optical images than we were able to do from the ground. And so you say, I think there's a black hole in the center of this galaxy. I'm not sure. You bring in Hubble. Yep, we got a black hole right there. Mm-hmm. Okay? So there was a lot of that kind of, let me affirm what I suspect is true, given the quality of data that Hubble was giving us.
Does a black hole really look like a black hole? Well, every time I see these pictures, there's a black hole there. I don't see a little circle that's
sorry,
dark.
I should reword your question. Does a black hole look like a hole that's black?
Yes.
Right. Because, of course, a black hole looks like a black hole. You know, Leonard Lopez looks like Leonard Lopez.
we earlier had this whole thing about dark matter that turns out not to be matter, probably.
No, I don't know what it is. I don't want to name it until we know what it is. So that's why I'm sticking with Fred. I would say the representation of the wormhole and other attempts to show the event horizon of a black hole in the film Interstellar were masterfully done. And they had a PhD physicist as an advisor to it who not only oversaw the visualizations but also co-wrote the story.
We are inviting your calls to 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Let's take a call from Tom from Queens. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. My question to you is, you know that the universe is expanding because of the Doppler effect on the red shift, yet Einstein said that light always looks like it's coming at the same speed to each person. Isn't that a contradiction?
No. One is the expansion of the universe itself. So the movement of the stretching of the fabric of space and time that exist and on which all the galaxies are, in which all the galaxies and other matter are embedded. So that's just the stretching of space and time. And now there's just simply the speed of light. And so you want to talk about the speed of light, you will always measure it to be the same value, just as prescribed in Einstein's special theory of relativity. By the way, this year is the 100th anniversary of Einstein advancing the general theory of relativity. So you'll probably see more discussion of this as the year unfolds.
Because that was one of the great scientific concepts.
Yes. Oh, it was a towering
achievement everything.
Of human intellect. Yes. Yes.
You want to add something, Tom?
Yes, I'd like to find out, E is equal to mc squared. Can that be reversed so that energy becomes matter, or is it only energy to matter?
Yeah, so here I can do you one better. Energy and matter are the same thing.
But not gravity necessarily.
They are, one can become the other, they can go back and forth. They don't distinguish one, they have, it's a two-way street between the two of them.
Thank you for your call. We go now to Susan in Long Island. Hi, Susan, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much. And good afternoon, Dr. deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah,
I'm a big fan. I wish you would give more lectures at the museum so that I could, continue my pursuit of listening to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
I realize you've been very busy on the media, so good for that, too.
Yeah.
My question is kind of, I don't know, I'm not a scientist. I'm an English major of decades ago. And so my question is, when I was young, I could reverse engineer the technology around me with the science and math that I was learning in grade school and in high school. So I can't do it anymore, but I could reverse engineer, I could look at the TV and reverse engineer a cathode ray tube, or I could look at a car and reverse engineer an internal combustion engine. And so now I find myself living in a world, and I don't know if this is true of the younger generations of people, but I now live in a world where I look at the microwave oven, I haven't a clue, I just don't use it anymore. We are surrounded by technology since the microchip and the nano this and the, nano that. We can't reverse engineer it in our minds, or at least I can't with the science that I learned back then. Are students now able to do that with the science that they're learning? I mean, I realize also that when I was in kindergarten, an abacus was still a thing in the classroom, and I'm sure it's long since disappeared.
Susan, let me jump in. Are you asking, has science become more complicated in recent years?
Yes, and is there a way that we can close that gap again? Because I think people should be able to reverse engineer the technology around them to a practical degree.
Okay, so I got you. I got you here. So first of all, you had an abacus in your How old are you?
I had an abacus when I was
okay,
a kid.
Okay, no, I'm
too.
Just
that's
kidding. I kid.
Came with the Lego set.
I kid. So what you are observing there is the transition from macroscopic physical devices that are largely based on classical physics to microscopic physical devices that are largely based and enabled by quantum physics. So you will see a car, and you'll see there's a piston, and there's gas, and there's a pedal, and there's a valve, and these are machines, and so we have the capacity to interpret machines such as what would have come of the Industrial Revolution. So there you have it. And even if you take one electricity class, you can follow where the electrons are coming through the cathode ray tube, and there's other tubes. Yeah, you get some distance in there. Quantum physics, which was pioneered in the 1920s, is the foundation of the IT revolution. And in fact, by some measures, it accounts for up to one-third of the total value of product in the world that is derived from the creation, storage, and retrieval of information in modern times. The creation, storage, and retrieval of information is based on principles of quantum physics, discovered in the 1920s, finally turned into product 50 years later, beginning in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I can assure you that none of the people using their cell, most of the people using the cell phone have no freaking idea how the thing works. But they don't, that they don't care. Do you really know, if you were riding horses and buggies, could you say you really understand the physiology of a horse? So you're not expected to fully understand anything you use, as long as it's valuable to how you conduct your life. I don't think that's where the tragedies are in modern life. The tragedies are people in denial of emergent scientific truths, such as what we are doing to our climate, such as solutions necessary to solve our energy problems, our transportation problems, our housing problems. People in denial of the role that science and technology can play in that, that's where the problems are. Don't worry that you can't reverse engineer your cell phone.
My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson on today's Please Explain. Stay with us for more. We're back with Neil deGrasse Tyson on today's Please Explain, and we're talking about space and related matters. I guess we said we were going to explain all of the secrets and mysteries of the cosmos, since you had a series called Cosmos.
Well, I just can't believe that before the break, you segued from quantum physics to a Knish. That is the first time in the history of the universe anyone has ever accomplished that.
Well, Knish kind of represents tradition, represents old thinking, but there's something still comforting about it in the same way that Newtonian physics is comforting.
That's a perceptive point. Newtonian physics emanates from our life experience largely, whereas quantum physics does not. And so you can't use what you would call common sense as a means of judging what is or is not true in the quantum realm.
A listener on our show page asks how quantum entanglement is communicated. First of all, what's quantum entanglement?
You can have part. So one of the spooky, mysterious things of quantum physics. Let me again reaffirm that quantum physics has no obligation to make sense to you, because it exists completely outside of our sensory experience. So what we describe as what goes on in quantum physics is the consequence of experiments. And so you can say that doesn't make sense. Fine, that doesn't care, right? So quantum entanglement is a purely quantum phenomenon where you have a particle that communicates properties of itself in tandem with another particle. And so their information is bound together. And this information moves between them instantaneously, faster than the speed of light. And it remains a mystery. The question was, how does it happen? We have no idea. That's really my answer. We have no idea. But it does happen. And there's talk about, can we communicate faster than light if we turned this quantum phenomenon into a macroscopic phenomenon? And that way you can communicate across the galaxy instantaneously. And we don't know how to do that, or even if it's possible.
So much of this is done through mathematics. And over the years, we've had a number of physicists come on to talk about string theory. Most of them were engaged in that work. They all had different numbers of dimensions and to explain it. But all of their math seemed to work out, and yet we do not accept string theory as the answer yet. Or do you think we ever will?
Well, let me clarify what role math plays. So math is not some magical panacea. What happens is you come up with an idea of how the universe might work. It's a hypothesis. And then you make a mathematical image of that idea that allows you to maneuver, manipulate, massage the idea using purely logical steps. Because if you just did it in using English vocabulary or anybody's vocabulary, you don't know for sure whether a conclusion you draw is logically derived from the premise that you established until you set up the mathematical model of that idea. Once you do that, push the equations to their limit. Maybe there's a discovery that you have unearthed about your idea that just thinking about the idea in its purest form could not have revealed to you. So that's the role that math plays in cosmic discovery. So yeah, you've got string theory. They're still working on the ideas. Are the ideas right? And the math is...
Nobody seems to agree. Many people are committed to it, but one scientist said to me, never in the history of science have so many brilliant minds been devoted to coming up with something that is not going to turn out to be true.
Yeah, I think it's premature, even though it's been decades. waiting for the great single equation that describes all the known laws of physics. It's a premature to assert that nothing will come of it. It's possible that if you explore string theory, something else might come out of it that you hadn't thought of, because you went down a path where there's a left turn or a right turn that gives you a fresh idea about how all of this works.
In one of the episodes of your upcoming TV show, you talk about Star Trek and interview George Takei. And Alan Stofan, one of NASA's top scientists, recently predicted that we would find evidence of alien life in the next decade.
Yeah, I would. Did you say decade or decades?
I guess plural. Decades. I don't know.
Yeah, that should
I've
be a plural. She would know better to make that a plural. So I agree with that, but I would sharpen it a little further. And I would say in the coming decades, two or three decades, we will know enough about life, the possibility of life in the solar system, to say with some confidence whether it's there or not.
Although it won't be life as we necessarily recognize it, or it could just be viral, microbial.
Oh, yeah. If it's at all, it'd be microbial for sure. In other words, here's a good way to think about it. If there's macroscopic life there, like with limbs and things, there would likely also be life that's much smaller. Because you don't get big life without having small life that preceded it.
But in the past, we always assumed that if we put up all of these antennas, we're going to hear somebody from another.
Oh, that would be intelligent life.
Yeah.
Or life with technology.
That might be more difficult.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't confuse having technology with having intelligence.
Well, as people have pointed out on Earth, that we're still searching for intelligent life here.
Right, but we certainly have technology. So, yeah, if you want to find life that you might have a conversation with, that's a different exercise than just poking around the puddles of water that we might find in the solar system.
I was amused when we sent off some rocket with a Beatles record on it, as though somebody would know how to play it. But that was years ago.
Oh, on Voyager, it had music. There was a Voyager record album that was attached to the side of the craft, and it was, and so it had music of all different genres. It had Bach and Chuck Berry, and it was an attempt to share with an alien who might discover the spacecraft a little bit of something of who we are and who made the craft.
If they could play it, but that's a whole other thing. Ben from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon to the both of you guys, and I'm going to get to the point.
Good.
Plasma rockets, what do you think about that? Because to my understanding, if we can develop this plasma rocket, we will be able to go to Mars, say, for example, in three weeks.
Yes,
instead of four months, and plus you can track down the planet like they do in Star Trek, of course not as fast, instead of waiting for the planet to be in a certain position. I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, excellent point. So right now we're using conventional, what we call chemical fuels, where it is a substance that has built in it stored energy in the form of chemical bonds. And then you burn it, and then flames come out the back, and you recoil. This is how we've basically launched everything that's ever come out of Earth. That's not the most efficient form of energy. Antimatter drives would be way better, but how do you hand someone a vessel that has antimatter in it? That's a big challenge. In what suitcase do you put the antimatter in, lest it then annihilate with the matter of the box itself? So with a plasma rocket, it has a very high efficiency in transmitting thrust to the object, to the vessel that it is. And if you can get to Mars in 3 weeks, that's great. Then you can do it between solar flares, and so it reduced risks, it reduced boredom, all of these things. One thing it won't get you to is the nearest stars. It will, but it still take you too long. You'll be dead long before you arrived.
A listener wonders, why do people cherry-pick science? They rely on cell phones, trust antibiotics, but don't believe that that climate change is real, or don't believe that evolution actually occurred.
Yeah, I'm a reductionist with regard to that question, and I would say that at the end of the day, it's a problem with how science is taught in the schools. I think we have a system that thinks that there's a student sitting there at the school desk, and you take science information and pour it into their heads, and then they regurgitate it back for an exam, and if they get a high score, then they are scientifically literate without ever learning what science is, how it works, why it works, and having some understanding of the methods and tools of science and how it is we arrive at what we call an objective truth. Without that background, people don't know why something can or should be believed versus something else. So I don't know that I can blame them. So it requires a reform to the way science is taught in our schools.
But we've had a number of teachers, another number of politicians, presidents, who've said we have to teach science better. Has that had any impact?
Well, no. Well, some funds have been made available. Here's the problem.
Do you think that politicians should take that course?
Yeah. No, the people who vote for politicians should take that course. Then you would never have the situation of a politician needing such a course because they wouldn't have gotten into office in the first place. So the difference is that you the science, as you teach it, here's the problem. At the federal level, the Constitution makes no specification for how you would educate the electorate. Therefore, it falls in the hands of the states. So therefore, the president actually has no power whatsoever.
Except the bully pulpit.
Yeah, except the bully pulpit.
Glenn from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Quick.
Doctor, I have a question about doing the speed of light. If we or can achieve the speed of light, how will that change our perception of time, either to us or to other people?
Yeah, great. If you manage to travel the speed of light, time will no longer tick for you as anyone elsewhere would observe it. And so the whole universe will unfold, and you will see the future history of the universe pass before your eyes in an instant.
And we have run out of time. And I did want to ask about the black hole.
Just on the question where he's asking me about time, now we ran out of time?
Yes.
You got to do better than that next time. All right. Sorry.
Well, time waits for no man. Mm-hmm. There's a massive hole in the middle of the Milky Way galaxy.
Black hole, yes.
A black hole, I mean. Does that affect the way our everyday life?
No, not at all, but just don't wander too close to it because you're not coming back.
And will it stay there forever?
Yeah. Black holes, well, once it eats everything it can, then it will slowly evaporate, according to quantum gravity Hawking radiation. You will lose a black hole eventually.
And I want to remind you, Neil deGrasse Tyson's new late-night television show is called Star Talk. It's on National Geographic Channel. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.